Good morning. You're listening to KYRS. You're also listening to Praxis. I'm your host, Taylor, and for the third week in a row, I'm on my own in the studio, getting comfortable with that once again. And today, I decided to talk about something that's both very easy and very difficult for me to talk about, which is the feminism. Putting the in front of it just because I like to. I guess it's so interesting because this is a topic that comes up a lot, and I had a lot of upheaval related to the subject of feminism and identifying as a feminist earlier this year that was mostly through Facebook, which was part of my decision to get rid of my personal Facebook, which I now have again for a variety of other reasons. And as I do often on shows when I'm by myself, I've posted a little question to followers of the show on Facebook, which you can find at facebook.com/praxisradio. And about, you know, do you consider yourself a feminist and what does that mean to you? And I'm assuming the people who like it do consider themselves feminists. Here's some of the things that means to people. And then we'll get into a little bit of history and a little bit of, I guess, analysis from others and from myself about what we're looking at today and what the state of the patriarchy and state of the feminism might be at this moment. And I'll take some calls in the second half of the show also when I'm not in the middle of reading some history stuff. So jam-packed hour, hopefully. So what does being a feminist mean to the people of Facebook? Fighting the patriarchy. With 3 likes. That seems to be a popular, succinct way to say it. It means my wife always gets the first and last word as well as everything in between. So there's some personal relationship dynamics. It means that I'm empowered with the knowledge I as a woman need to make sense of the world around me, and I have the tools available to establish my place in that world. It's kind of a personal look at it. Another person says, breaking down the gender binary, which serves mainly to solidify white male power. Well, there we go. And someone else expanding on that afterwards, I think ideas like feminism perpetuate and reinforce the human behavior of identifying and defining people based on perception of gender. If we want to eradicate the destructive presence of patriarchy, we need to eradicate the assumption that people can and should be identified and defined by gender. Which, I totally agree with that. I said, I see patriarchy as interlocking systems which use force to keep me identified by my gender and the qualities ascribed to it by other people. This person says, agreed. Patriarchy is the direct result of defining by gender. So that stance that these last two people brought up about breaking down the gender binary, that is the focus of the wing currently operating that would be considered radical feminism. It's to, you know, toward the abolition of gender roles altogether. Here is a long answer, the most recent answer, just 4 minutes ago. I embraced the concept in my 30s, in the mid-70s, when the second wave of feminism was helping us to see how language is used against us. I think bitch versus tough, shrill versus assertive. The medical profession had made our normal body processes a medical problem to be fixed. PMS, childbirth, etc. The psychiatric profession had made our emotions and intuition a laughingstock, and society followed suit as they all protected us. Don't worry your pretty little head, etc. And after World War II kicked women out of the factories in which we had been doing excellent work to make room for the boys when they came back from war, because obviously all of us had a man to take care of us and he needed my job to do that. Fireman, you can't do that work, obviously. Mailman, ditto. Policeman, ditto. And even genderless titles like doctor, scientist, etc. The list is far too long to put here, but I'll never forget the click game. Every time you heard one of those put-downs, you could look at your friend and the two of you would say, click, got it. As they piled up, we became more and more aware of the long struggle ahead and began the hard work of breaking free from the traps and empowering ourselves to make our own decisions to shape our own view of the world. Cool answer. Personal history. And that kind of brings us to, she talked about second wave feminism. And for those who haven't studied it, you know, generally feminism's talked about in 3 waves. And and there's people who put forward a fourth here and there. There's all kinds of you know, stuff going on right now as far as theories being developed. But I want to talk about, I want to start talking about history with second wave feminism, because so much of the third wave and what happened in the 80s and 90s up through today was a response and a critique of second wave feminism. And it's also interesting because right now, as far as the U.S. goes, we have a lot of, I guess, attacks from institutional structures on things that would be considered gains that were made by second wave feminism. So while there's an entire schools of critique on how the gains made during that time weren't enough, there's also an active attack on those gains now because there's a patriarchal structure that thinks they're too much. So those are pretty different ideas of how the world works. So hopefully we can kind of see how it got that way and see how things are operating now and start to figure out how to smash the patriarchy, like they said, and why that doesn't mean hating men. If you're a man or a woman or just a person who is in any way concerned that feminism is about hating men or that smashing the patriarchy is about hurting individual men, please stick around, because at the end of the show, we'll address that, and I hope that it will be a satisfactory answer for everyone who might have concerns. So, as usual, when I want to talk history, I usually start with Howard Zinn, with People's History of the United States. He has such great resources, such great things to point to, and I just really like the voice he wrote this book in, and you know, he's not a woman, but he takes the perspective of women in the beginning of this chapter. So he talks about, and the first wave of feminism is kind of the traditional suffrage movement, seeking equal rights, you know, on paper, the right to vote, etc. And that's where he jumps in here. Helen Keller had said in 1911, "We vote. What does that mean?" And Emma Goldman, around the same time, said, "Our modern fetish is universal suffrage. After 1920, women were voting, as men did, and their subordinate condition had hardly changed. Right after women got the vote, the measure of their social progress can be seen in an advice column written by Dorothy Dix that appeared in newspapers all over the country. The woman should not merely be a domestic drudge," she said, quote, "A man's wife is the show window where he exhibits the measure of his achievement. The biggest deals are put across over luncheon tables. We meet at dinner the people who can push our fortunes. The woman who cultivates a circle of worthwhile people, who belongs to clubs, who makes herself interesting and agreeable, is a help to her husband," end quote. Robert and Helen Lynn, studying in Muncie, Indiana, in the late 20s, noted the importance of good looks and dress in the assessment of women. Also, they found that when men spoke frankly among themselves, they were likely to speak of women as creatures purer and morally better than men, but as relatively impractical, emotional, unstable, given to prejudice, easily hurt, and largely incapable of facing facts or doing hard thinking. A writer in early 1930, boosting the beauty business, started off a magazine article with the sentence, "The average American woman has 16 square feet of skin." He went on to say that there were 40,000 beauty shops in the country and that $2 billion a year was spent each year on cosmetics for women, but that this was insufficient. American women are not yet spending even one-fifth of the amount necessary to improve their appearance. He then gave an itemized list of the annual beauty needs of every woman: 12 hot oil treatments, 52 facials, 26 eyebrow plucks, etc. It seems that women have best been able to make their first escape from the prison of wifeliness, motherhood, femininity, housework, beautification, isolation, when their services have been desperately needed, whether in industry or in war or in social movements. Each time practicality pulled the woman out of her prison in a kind of work parole program, the attempt was made to push her back once the need was over, and this led to women's struggle for change. I really like that assessment of his. That it's still, even when women are freed from their, you know, this one role that they traditionally had in the U.S., they're put into another very stock role. And then, I just love the work parole program. And this is what my friend was talking about in her comment about living through second wave feminism. World War II had brought more women than ever before out of the home into work. By 1960, 36% of all women 16 and older, 23 million women, worked for paid wages. But although 43% of women with school-aged children worked, there were nursery schools for only 2%. The rest had to work things out themselves. Women were 50% of the voters, but they held 4% of the state legislative seats and 2% of the judgeships. The median income of the working woman was about one-third that of the man, and attitudes toward women did not seem to have changed much since the 20s. And that figure now, average salary, is two-thirds that of the man. So, big gains there, but not actual equality, which is the goal. So, and I'll talk about the goal related to work more in just a second. We can continue. This is still Howard Zinn. There is no overt anti-feminism in our society in 1964, wrote feminist and sociologist Alice Rossi, not because sex equality has been achieved, but because there is practically no feminist spark left among American women. In the civil rights movement of the 60s, the signs of a collective stirring began to appear. Women took the place they customarily took in social movements, in the front lines, as privates, not generals. In the office of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in Atlanta, a Spelman College student named Ruby Doris Smith, who had been jailed during the sit-ins, expressed her anger at the way women were relegated to the routine office work, and she was joined in her protest by two white women in SNCC, Sandra Hayden and Mary King. The men in SNCC listened to them respectfully, read the position paper they had put together asserting their rights, but did not do very much. Ella Baker, a veteran fighter from Harlem, now organizing in the South, knew the pattern. She said, "I knew from the beginning that as a woman, an older woman in a group of ministers who are accustomed to having women largely as supporters, there was no place for me to come into a leadership role." Nevertheless, women played a crucial role in those early dangerous years of organizing in the South and were looked on with admiration. Many of these were older women like Ella Baker and Amelia Boynton in Selma, Alabama, and Mama Dolly in Albany, Georgia. Younger women, Gloria Richardson in Maryland, and Nell Ponder in Mississippi, were not only active, but leaders. Women of all ages demonstrated, went to jail. Miss Fannie Lou Hamer, a sharecropper in Ruleville, Mississippi, became legendary as an organizer and speaker. She sang hymns, she walked picket lines with her familiar limp. As a child, she contracted polio. She roused people to excitement at mass meetings. "I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired." Around the same time, white middle-class professional women were beginning to speak up. A pioneering early book, strong and influential, was Betty Friedan's The Feminine Mystique. This is an excerpt from that. "Just what was the problem that has no name? What were the words women used when they tried to express it? Sometimes a woman would say, 'I feel empty somehow, incomplete,' or she would say, 'I feel as if I don't exist.' Sometimes a tired feeling. I get so angry with the children it scares me. I feel like crying without any reason." Friedan wrote of her experience as a middle-class housewife, but what she spoke about touched something inside more women than just those. The problem lay buried, unspoken for many years in the mind of American women. This is Friedan again. "It was a strange stirring, a sense of dissatisfaction, a yearning that women suffered in the middle of the 20th century in the United States. Each suburban wife struggled with it alone, as she made beds, shopped for groceries, matched slipcover material, ate peanut butter sandwiches with her children, chauffeured Cub Scouts and brownies, lay beside her husband at night. She was afraid to ask even of herself the silent question, 'Is this all?' But on an April morning in 1959, I heard a mother of four having coffee with four other mothers in a suburban development 15 miles from New York say in a quiet tone of desperation, 'The problem.' And the others knew, without words, that she was not talking about a problem with her husband or her children or her home. Suddenly they realized they all shared the same problem, the problem that has no name. They began, hesitantly, to talk about it. Later, after they had picked up their children at nursery school and taken them home to nap, two of the women cried in sheer relief just to know they were not alone." The mystique that Friedan spoke of was the image of the woman as mother, as wife, living through her husband, through her children, giving up her own dreams for that. She concluded the only way for a woman, as for a man, to find herself, to know herself as a person, is by creative work of her own. In summer of 1964, in Macomb, Mississippi, at a Freedom House, a civil rights headquarters where people worked and lived together, the women went on strike against the men who wanted them to cook and make beds while the men went around in cars organizing. The stirring that Friedan spoke of was true of women everywhere, it seemed. By 1969, women were 40% of the entire labor force of the United States, but a substantial number of these were secretaries, cleaning women, elementary school teachers, saleswomen, waitresses, and nurses. One out of every three working women had a husband earning less than $5,000 a year. What of the women who didn't have jobs? They worked very hard at home, but this wasn't looked on as work, because in a capitalist society, or perhaps in any modern society where things and people are bought and sold for money, if work is not paid for, not given a money value, it is considered valueless. Women began to think more about this fact in the 60s, and Margaret Benson wrote about it in her essay, The Political Economy of Women's Liberation. Women doing housework were people outside the modern economic system. Therefore, they were like serfs or peasants, she said. The women who worked in the typical woman's job, secretary, receptionist, typist, salesperson, cleaning woman, nurse, were treated to the full range of humiliations that men in subordinate positions faced at work, plus another set of humiliations stemming from being a woman. Gibes at their mental processes, sexual jokes and aggression, invisibility except as sexual objects, cold demands for more efficiency. A commercial guide to clerical time standards printed a question and answer column that follows. Question. I'm a businessman, and my secretary seems to move entirely too slowly. How many times a minute should she be able to open and close a file drawer? Answer. Exactly 25 times. Times for other open and close operations are 0.04 minutes for opening or closing a folder and 0.026 minutes for opening a standard center desk drawer. If you're worried about her chair activity, clock her against these standards. Got up from chair, 0.033 minutes. Turn in swivel chair, 0.009 minutes. A woman factory worker in New Bedford, Massachusetts, in the early 70s, in a medium-sized corporation whose president's dividends from the corporation in 1970 amounted to $325,000, wrote in an organizing newspaper that 90% of the workers in her department were women, but all the supervisors were men. A few years ago, I was suspended for 3 days from work because my children were still young, and I had to take time off when they were sick. They want people to keep quiet, squeal on one another, and are very good little robots. The fact that many have to take nerve pills before starting their day and a week doesn't go by that there aren't two or three people who break down and cry doesn't mean a thing to them. She added, but times are changing, and from now on, more people will speak out and demand from their so-called bosses that they be treated the way bosses themselves would like to be treated. Times indeed were changing. Around 1967, women in various movements, civil rights, Students for a Democratic Society, anti-war groups, began meeting as women. In early 1968, at a women's anti-war meeting in Washington, hundreds of women carrying torches paraded to the Arlington National Cemetery and staged the burial of traditional womanhood. At this point, and later too, there was some disagreement among women, and even more among men, on whether women should battle on specifically women's issues, or just take part in general movements against racism, war, capitalism. But the idea of a feminist focus grew. So I'm going to stop there, because it's hard to read that much in a row. But this really intersects well. I forgot how well this section of the book intersects with what I talked about last week, the show, which is not podcast yet. I apologize for that. I'm going to update all of that later today. You can subscribe to that podcast at kyrs.org under Programs, Podcasts, Praxis, the three P's. And last week I talked about this idea of wage slavery and of, you know, working endlessly in this capitalist system, really for the gain of others rather than for yourself. And this is where that really intersects well with feminism and the history of feminism, because we see in the 60s and 70s, women assimilating into the workforce. But that doesn't necessarily correspond to that quote from Betty Friedan about the only way for a woman as for a man to find herself, to know herself as a person, is by creative work of her own. Working in a factory or as a secretary and typing someone else's notes isn't really creative work of your own. So really, in a lot of ways, the problems with second wave feminism were the same as the critique at the beginning of this reading that I started from Helen Keller and Emma Goldman about voting. You know, this kind of idea of, well, whoop-de-doo, we can vote. Who are we going to vote for? All of these men who are offering business as usual. Some things never change, apparently, 100 years later. I have to say I feel quite the same about voting as they did then. And then this idea of, well, you know, oh, join the workforce. That's kind of a similar, oh, great, and go work in a factory like the men are being so fulfilled by right now. So it really points to the human failings of this overall capitalist system of, you know, working for kind of abstract product that isn't, you're not going to really see the results of your own labor. So I have a really long response on Facebook. That's why I was hesitating there, that I will read in just a little bit because it corresponds with what I'm going to talk about with this shift. So then this chapter goes on to describe how the idea of intersectionality and that coming out a little bit, but what really stuck, the victories people generally think of when they think of second wave feminism, and the victories are Roe versus Wade and the access to legal abortion and legal birth control for women being a huge victory. Because before, you know, only women of privilege could really access safe birth in a lot of cases, or safe abortion if that was their choice. And the Equal Rights Amendment passed in cases of discrimination for hiring. But this is a pretty... I'm going to jump back in here. Many women were active in trying to get a constitutional amendment, ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, passed by enough states. But it seemed clear that even if it became law, it would not be enough, that what women had accomplished had come through organization, action, protest. Even where the law was helpful, it was helpful only if backed by action. Shirley Chisholm, a black congresswoman, said, "The law cannot do it for us. We must do it for ourselves. Women in this country must become revolutionaries. We must refuse to accept the old, the traditional roles and stereotypes. We must replace the old negative thoughts about our femininity with positive thoughts and positive action." Perhaps the most profound effect of the women's movement of the 60s, beyond the actual victories on abortion and job equality, was called consciousness raising, often done in women's groups, which met in homes all across the country. This meant the rethinking of roles, the rejection of inferiority, the confidence in self, a bond of sisterhood, a new solidarity of mother and daughter. For the first time, the sheer biological uniqueness of women was openly discussed. And that's this talking about, and then this shifts into talking about female embodiment. And I will... hop into that also. Yeah. Rich said, he's talking about Adrienne Rich, who wrote of Woman Born, "Women are controlled by lashing us to our bodies." And this is what we were discussing in that Facebook post about patriarchy being the system that uses force to link women specifically and men by extension to their gender as a prime identifying factor in their identity. Rich said women could use the body, quote, "as a resource rather than a destiny. Patriarchal systems," she said, "whether under capitalism or socialism, limited women's bodies to their own needs." She discussed the training of passivity in women. Generations of schoolgirls were raised on Little Women, where Jo is told by her mother, "I am angry nearly every day of my life, Jo, but I've learned not to show it, and I still hope to learn not to feel it, though it may take me another 40 years to do so." Male doctors used instruments to bring out children, replacing the sensitive hands of midwives in the area of anesthetized technologized childbirth. Sorry. Rich disagreed with her fellow feminist Firestone, who wanted to change the biological inevitability of childbirth because it is painful and a source of subordination. She wanted, under different social conditions, to make childbirth a source of physical and emotional joy. "One could not talk of Freud's ignorance of women," Rich said, as his one blind spot, which implied that in all other matters his vision was clear. Such ignorance distorts all. There is a dilemma of the body. "I know no woman, virgin, mother, lesbian, married, celibate, whether she earns her keep as a housewife, a cocktail waitress, or a scanner of brainwaves, for whom her body is not a fundamental problem. Its clouded meaning, its fertility, its desire, its so-called frigidity, its bloody speech, its silences, its changes and mutilations, its rapes and ripenings." That was Freud. Her reply to this, "the repossession of our bodies, a world in which every woman is the presiding genius of her own body, as a basis for bringing forth not just children, but new visions, new meanings, a new world." For most women who were not intellectuals, the question was even more immediate: how to eliminate hunger, suffering, subordination, humiliation in the here and now. A woman named Johnny Tillman wrote in 1972, "I'm a woman. I'm a black woman. I'm a poor woman. I'm a fat woman. I'm a middle-aged woman, and I'm on welfare. I have raised 6 children. I grew up in Arkansas, worked there for 15 years in a laundry, moved to California. In 1963, I got too sick to work anymore. Friends helped me go on welfare. Welfare is like a traffic accident. It can happen to anybody, but especially it happens to women. And that is why welfare is a women's issue. For a lot of middle-class women in this country, women's liberation is a matter of concern. For women on welfare, it's a matter of survival. Welfare, she said, was like a super sexist marriage. You trade an A man for the man. The man runs everything, controls your money. She and other welfare mothers organized a national welfare rights organization. They urged that women be paid for their work, housekeeping, child rearing. No woman can be liberated, she said, until all women get off their knees. So that's where I'm going to stop with the Howard Zinn excerpt, but there's a lot of good information there, and that talks about many issues that, shocker, we're still talking about today, 40 to 50 years later. And some of my favorite women who I most like to talk to about things like this are women who are currently, you know, in their 50s through 70s who lived through a lot of this. And I have one friend who I used to work with who's still meeting with her women's group. He was talking about the importance of the consciousness raising that happened in these groups of women. They've been meeting monthly for 35 to 40 years, and you know, they've gone from rabble rousing and doing pro-choice graffiti in Spokane in the Reagan years to still meeting, you know, still talking, still raising hell. So that's a really cool tie-in. And we see now, I mean, not only this still constant anti-abortion debate led largely by men, which if that's not patriarchy, I don't know what else can be called that. And we also have attacks on, you know, social welfare programs, which I would argue still do disproportionately affect women and children. So all of this is still happening. And then, all of this that we've been talking about falls under the category of second wave feminism. And he started to talk about, intersectionality, which is the idea of, you know, the main critique against Betty Friedan and the feminist mystique and all of that is that it's a very white focused, you know, suburban housewife. That's not every woman. It's, and nothing is every woman. But it didn't focus as much on the overall structure. And as that chapter progressed, as we started talking more about the economic intersectionality, the racial intersectionality, it comes out. Those conversations were happening, but not in the larger way that they began to in the 80s and 90s. Third wave feminism began in the early 1990s in response to what young women perceived as failures of the second wave. It also responds to the backlash against second wave initiatives and movements. Third wave feminism seeks to challenge or avoid second wave essentialist definitions of femininity, which overemphasize the experiences of white upper middle class women. A post-structuralist interpretation of gender and sexuality, or an understanding of gender as outside binary maleness and femaleness, is central to much of third wave's ideology. Third wave feminists often describe micropolitics and challenge second wave paradigms about whether actions are unilaterally good for females. So, talking more about this, you know, there isn't one femininity, and getting out of the gender binary is really the way to get out of gender-based oppression. Which leads right into the most recent response to my Facebook question, do you consider yourself a feminist? What does that mean to you? And if you want to call in and share your answer to that, feel free. Studio line is open. It's 747-3807. This is a comment from a friend. I really do not want to go over what above has gone over, but I do want to share this, which I agree with. What it means to be a radical feminist by Mary Daly. This passage was taken from a talk given by Mary Daly at UCLA in 1987. It is more relevant today than ever. Being a radical feminist involves a radical, awesome, ecstatic sense of otherness from what the patriarchy wants me to be. I am not a patriarchal woman. I do not want any of that. Least of all do I want their plastic passions, the bitterness, the depression, the resignation, fulfillment. Where is there to move? It implies a knowledge of the sanctions that will come down from the patriarchy. But I make this decision anyway because I know that I will be punished just as much for being an itty-bitty feminist as for going the whole way. And so I go the whole way. Radical feminism means I experience moral outrage on behalf of women as women. I don't get sidetracked into other categories. I don't get distracted into any male-identified categories. I feel for the foot-maimed women of China, who for 1,000 years had a 3-inch-long foot. I feel for the genitally mutilated women of Africa, at least 30 million of them. And I will not be put down by ridiculous statements that this is racist. I feel for the women, the sisters who were massacred as witches in Western Europe during the so-called Renaissance, and for those women now massacred in the perpetual witch craze of patriarchy. Radical feminism means that I identify with women beyond all racial, ethnic, class, age bonds, or bounds. It means I see the oppression by gynecology and by our Western medicine, by Indian Sote, which still goes on, or by the dowry murders there, by the incest here, by the battering here, there, and everywhere of women, euphemistically called domestic violence. That kind of reversal language, and for women who are raped, and for women who are victims of pornographic abuse. Radical feminism involves steadfastness, and that means constancy, that means persistence, that means that when it is not cool to be a radical feminist, and it never really is, that I will be anyway for a very simple reason, and this makes me the lunatic that I am, that even if I were the last one, I would be because I am a woman, that's who I am. I'm not something else, to identify with something else, to be always for somebody else's cause. March, march, march. Prance, prance, prance. Fight, fight, fight. Some other boys or male-identified war. I am a woman. That's what radical feminism is. So that's Mary Daly, shared by a friend on my Facebook page for my question there. So now the issue is, where are we today with this notion of women and how are women treated? And I kind of want to start with this interesting article, and then I want to loop back to what I promised I would address about how hating the patriarchy doesn't mean hating men, individual men, or men as a group. But this is an article I found on, I don't remember what I found it through originally. It's on Tazeen.net, T-A-Z-E-E-N, Tazeen's blog. And it's called the F word, which isn't the one we can't say on the radio. It's the feminism word. And this is her take on that. Let's just be very clear about one thing. Feminist was never a very popular label to begin with. Since the first wave of feminism, feminists were labeled as man-hating, religion-shunning, morally ambiguous beings challenging the social order of the day. Though some things have changed since then, women's suffrage is almost universal, and most constitutions grant their female citizens basic civil rights, quite a few remains just as tough, and the stigma attached to the label feminist is just as clear and present as it was at the turn of the 20th century. While this abhorrence of the term feminist is quite commonplace, there is a new trend emerging of late. Female celebrities are getting up and denouncing feminism, and declaring it in the loudest possible voice that they are not feminists. Why this regression in thought? Once upon a time, we've had female celebrities who were headstrong and had no qualms about ruffling a few feathers and coming out as strong and independent women, be it Mae West or Dorothy Parker. Now, everyone from Beyoncé Knowles to Taylor Swift to Gwyneth Paltrow to Madhuri Dixit is at pains to declare it to the world that they are not feminists. Just mention it to a female celebrity that she is considered a strong woman by her audience, and perhaps she is a feminist, and chances are you will end up facing a deluge of words telling you that they are, oh, so not a feminist. On one end, you have someone like Lady Gaga, who made absolutely no sense when she said, quote, "I am not a feminist. I hail men. I love men. I celebrate American male and beer and bars and muscle cars," end quote. Because frankly, a 5-year-old, if he or she could articulate, would tell you that appreciation for beers or bars, loving men, or demanding equality among genders are not mutually exclusive. On the other hand, you have Gwyneth Paltrow, who distanced herself from feminism by stating that feminist activist Gloria Steinem wouldn't approve of her lifestyle, having chosen to compromise her career for her family and relationship. Since when did the approval of one woman, no matter how iconic a feminist she was, define feminism and what it entails? Someone needs to tell Ms. Paltrow that liberty of choosing a certain lifestyle is one of the basic tenets of feminism. As late as earlier this year, Beyoncé in an interview stated, quote, "That word, feminist, can be very extreme. I do believe in equality, but I'm happily married. I love my husband," end quote, Somehow Miss Knowles is under the impression that being happily married, having a family, and loving your husband do not make one a feminist. Demi Moore also joined the idiot bandwagon when she said that she finds the term feminism obsolete because the world does not need it anymore. She says, quote, "I'm a great supporter of women, but I've never really thought of myself as a feminist. I think clearly times have changed and women have made their mark in many different areas." I'm going to interrupt really quick. That's the classic female CEO argument that, you know, that really shows her privilege as, you know, a famous white, rich, very rich woman, you know, to be able to say, oh, well, you know, women have made their mark. Kind of, I have my success is implied in that. And so we're fine. There's no structural barriers to success. When really, you know, it was partially her, she's the kind of woman that a patriarchal system allows to succeed based on, you know, qualities, willingness to do the type of work that's relegated to women, reliance on physical attractiveness and sexuality, etc. So it's kind of a little privilege gleaming statement there. Continue with this article here. Closer to home, Madhuri Dixit shunned the word feminist quite vociferously. Quote, "I don't think I'm a feminist. I'm independent and strong, which is what women should be like." End quote. As far as homegrown Pakistani celebrities are concerned, there's been no mention of the word feminist or feminism in any public discussion or media interaction. Probably because our discourse is so religion heavy, it does not leave any room for non-religious debate on anything, most certainly not on feminism. It must be noted that despite eschewing the term feminism, these celebrities also try and tell the world that they are strong women who believe in equality and fair play, because who would want to be called submissive, pliant, and weak, right? Well, newsflash for them, because if they believe that women should be strong and independent and have the same rights at home, workplace, and in the society, then they too are feminists. They are just too much of chicken to align themselves with the world and admit it publicly. Why this rejection of the word? Is it because of all the misconceptions related to the word, which basically says that all feminists are argumentative, dour-faced, men-hating lesbians? Though in my opinion, there's nothing wrong with being either dour-faced, argumentative, or lesbian. Is it because the celebs fear that by associating themselves with feminism, they will lose their popularity? Is it because we live in the social media dominated age where celebrities are constantly interacting with their fans and know what is expected of them and act and say the things accordingly? Or is it because these feminism shunning celebrities have given someone else the power to define what is acceptable, and feminism is not, and label themselves accordingly? It is perhaps all the reasons cited above and more. Celebrities like Demi Moore and Lady Gaga rely on their popularity for their success and financial gains and are afraid to use the F word. But it also drives home the point that there is no level playing field for women if they have to come out and say that they are not feminists. If anything tells us the world needs feminism and its feminist icons and role models. Feminists do not hate men in general. Most of the women who label themselves as feminists like men just fine. In fact, they may state it more openly than their patriarchy-endorsing sisters, but that's not the point here. The point here is that they may like or dislike people for various reasons, and they can be both men and women. That's the core of what I'm hoping to get to about this supposed specter of misandry later on. But I'm going to continue this article, again, from tazeen.net, T-A-Z-E-N.net. From Susan Sarandon to Beyoncé, despite espousing the principles of feminism, they all shun the word. Beyoncé suggested that something like bootylicious should replace feminism, while Sarandon thinks humanist is a better word. But is that even the point? Had that been a natural progression of language, where one word gives way to another, it would have been perfectly fine, but it's not the case here. Female celebrities, who are role models to so many, are actively shunning the word because of the negativity associated with it. It's not just a matter of semantics. There's a long history associated with the word, and shunning it would mean not only denying that legacy, but also dishonoring the struggles of women who made possible the freedoms we enjoy today through their efforts. Before these women get up and denounce feminism, have they stopped and pondered that it is feminism that has won us the vote, equal pay, at least in the law, the contraceptive options, property rights, and right to education, among others? No matter what Demi Moore believes in, we are nowhere close to a world where feminism is not needed. The world is still deeply unequal, and women everywhere are victims of discrimination on the basis of sex, and it is dishonest to say that a feminism-based rights movement is redundant. even the nature of struggle has not changed, at least in a country like Pakistan, where despite universal adult suffrage, there are pockets where women are not allowed to vote, and no woman celeb had the decency to raise voice against it. There was a time when associating oneself with gay rights was considered social harakiri. Now there's hardly anyone, at least in the Western world, who would openly say they are against equal rights for lesbians and gays. And this change happened because some people had the courage to get up and support what they believed in. Feminism needs such champions now. Ellen Page is one of those rare celebrities who wear their feminist identity with pride. She's not afraid of the label and believes it needs to be out there. How could it be any more obvious that we still live in a patriarchal world when feminism is considered a bad word? Asks Page. Yes, these celebrities are no gender theorists, and expecting them to be well-versed in the academics of feminism is unrealistic, but expecting them to not disown feminism because it would mean more Twitter followers or more popularity amongst the patriarchy's supporting majority is not asking a lot. As famous people with clout, it is their responsibility to impact upon others to strive for a more just world. In any case, human beings are not just defined by one single label. We are complex creatures and comprised of multiple identities. Liberal or conservative, humanist, conformist or nonconformist, Democrat, socialist or capitalist, and so on. It is about time we put an end to this ban on feminism as an articulated political and social concept, and celebrities like Ellen Page, Keira Knightley, and Patrick Stewart, yes, men can be feminists too, who flaunt their feminist ideology, will help in mainstreaming the word and the ideology. Say it now, feminism is not a bad word. There's nothing wrong with being a feminist. I just hope that more people embrace it and help in ridding the world of all negative connotations. So it was longer read aloud than it was. I forget how quickly I read to myself, but I think a good article nonetheless. And while I don't personally want to support like celebrity Hollywood culture, it's a fact that many people do look to that the mainstream pop culture for norms, for what are social norms, and with a lot of influential women who are, you know, hailed as strong women for either, you know, using their sexuality to gain wealth and power or not doing that or claiming to not do that while still doing it in some ways. It's very complicated, and it's interesting that she focused on that. Another young female celebrity who I personally am glad is out there to counter some of this anti-feminism whatnot. Emma Stone, as an actress, had this great quote. She was in an interview with a male co-star in a movie, and they were doing kind of a roundtable discussion. And the interviewer brought up that an answer, he had been asked what he'd be doing if he wasn't acting, what are his other interests, what was his career plan before he was discovered as an actor. And the male actor answered the question and then asked Emma Stone what her answer to that was. And she said, you know, I've never been asked that in an interview before. And he said, why do you think that is? And she said, well, I'm asked about fashion and clothes and what my favorite kind of shoes are. And you're asked interesting questions about your life and who you are as a person. She's like, and that's the patriarchy. And it was awesome to hear that in an interview. So she's one tally on the list of, I guess, openly out feminist celebrities. So let's see if this is another. We have another answer to this. Do you consider yourself a feminist? It's very long, but I could go through it. So the local tie that kind of kicked this off for me, I guess. I mean, I'm kind of always thinking about feminism, and I'm thinking about the patriarchy quite a bit, and I'm thinking about all of it, not because I have, you know, an obsession with finding it everywhere, but because it finds me. I'm a woman. That's part of just the social reality of my life. You know, I'd say it's safe to say that every day I encounter some type of street harassment from men who have been enculturated by a society that, you know, women are objects and that's how they can be treated. So until that doesn't happen to me every day, that's going to be an issue for me. Just issues of language that people use really thoughtlessly, that I'm confronted with all the time. this idea of mansplaining, which I think is just a term the internet has collectively invented over the last couple of years. But this constant experience of having men explain to me what my experience is or ought to be is a constant. And I'm reading more and more and talking to many friends in the academic realm where that's more of a problem than it is in the so-called real world. And lately, the city government in Spokane, not all of it, but one of our city councilmen, Mike Fagan, has been on a recent crusade of sorts against bikini baristas. So I'm sure as many people know, if you've driven on some of our more sprawly arterials, Division, Sprague, we have this phenomenon of the bikini barista espresso stand, or now the lingerie espresso stand, or the fully like topless Tuesday espresso stand. Personally, I couldn't care less. I think it's sad. I don't really want to live in a culture that demands women dress scantily in order to make coffee for someone. That's not where I want to live. That's not where I want to work. But that's capitalism, baby. That's what the culture wants. And if you want to have a capitalist system and a free market, it turns out that a lot of people are going to end up being exploited by that and choosing to some extent to exploit themselves that way in exchange for money, for a job. So that's what this system looks like, and there's an ugly side to it, and I think it's important that people see that it's ugly so that they can choose something else. But this is a great article written by fellow KYRS DJ Elena Becker, who also writes for the Spovangelist, and co-hosts The Other 50%, which is a weekly show here, bi-weekly show about the feminism. Very awesome. And this is her article today about why Fagan cares about bikini baristas. City Councilman Mike Fagan is up in arms over bikini baristas. Bikini baristas are up in arms over Fagan's newest proposal. The councilman representing the first city council district, U District up to Hilliard, wants to require a minimum clothing regulation or move to zoned adult business areas. There's really no right way to feel about this. So many things about lingerie and bikini espresso stands repulse me. They defame the good name of espresso everywhere, objectify and over-sexualize often very young women. Most people understand that the word objectification is a bad thing, but it's deeper than that. It's more than just a word. Our culture has made the female form a source of fascination, a white whale of sexual desire, which creates businesses like strip clubs, bikini barista stands, and a whole lot of trouble. Objectification is true to the definition of the word. It takes human beings and reframes worth from intellectual contributions, kindness, humor, love, and transforms it into sexual worth. Objects can't be hurt because they are inanimate, but when you turn women into objects, it makes things like catcalls, sexual harassment, and even sexual violence more justified in the mind of aggressors and general d-bags. Bikini barista stands may seem fun or even funny, but are fundamentally damaging to our community. Places like bikini barista stands are not really to blame. They're merely capitalizing on the built culture surrounding women and women's bodies. Read, it's all our fault. The toxicity of bikini barista stands aside, Councilman Fagan's proposal is still plain wrong. First, allowing middle-aged white dudes to tell women what is acceptable and unacceptable behavior is exactly what we talk about when we talk about gender equality. That's mansplaining that I just said. That's my note. Going back to what Ms. Becker is writing, Mike Fagan is, perhaps unwittingly, attempting to institute policies that are directly interfering with the independence and free will of women. And sir, we have enough of that patriarchal BS without the help of our city government. Even more concerning is that Councilman Fagan is a self-proclaimed libertarian, meaning with every other concern, he is supportive of free market ideals and supports little governmental intervention, except when it has to do with dictating the values of other people, unequivocally proving he is attempting to institute a policy that is inherently sexist on purpose. Second, it's not the place of city government to decide the value system of its constituency, but to support the vital services the city provides. In the Spokesman Review article on the bikini barista cover-up proposal, City Council President Ben Stucker was quoted with the perspective of a strong leader, quote, "Who decides what Spokane values are? I didn't get elected to legislate values. We should be talking about economic development, the creation of the budget, and police accountability," end quote. The thing about sexism is that we have a choice. Our culture isn't hardwired to be oppressive. We have the option to reframe the way we talk about sex, the way we talk about our bodies, and the way we evaluate the inherent value of humans. We have the power. We also have the power to buy good coffee from people that wear clothes. So that's Elena Becker writing on The Spovangelist about this whole bikini barista thing happening at City Hall. And I appreciate that she points out the hypocrisy of a so-called libertarian wanting to not only, you know, impose the dreaded government regulations on businesses, but on select businesses in matters of, you know, values, as she says. There seems to be a lot of this strange overlap with people really concerned about letting businesses have freedom, but wanting to restrict actual, like, choice freedom as far as what people do with their own bodies. Specifically tends to be women who need to be controlled. I guess there's a dangerous element there. So
I have two more responses, maybe three, actually, if we refresh.
Oh, well, thanks, Holly. Your show is going great. Thanks for reading my response. I'm really glad to hear your local tie-in. Thanks for a great show. It's good to be able to get live feedback from people. We have another response here. Feminism is another ism fueling the fire of identity politics that divides and conquers, that breeds anxiety and feeds prejudice, that places one in the mindset of the victim, assuming the only solution to inequality is begging government to formally recognize the status of a minority population. The best government can do, as it did when confronted with racism, will be to erect a few statues, maybe add a few holidays on the calendar, and mandate all state schools preach a watered-down, anti-radical brand of feminism that will pose no threat to the state or its institutions. The authority of its discourse has been taken over by the institution of higher education and rendered ineffective to produce a revolutionary movement capable of true change. But damn does it try to absolve the guilt associated with perpetuating the massive contradictions. Equality will come when women turn the tables and assume the role of authority over victim, when they demand it, not beg for it. Everyday acts of resistance. Full agreement there from me. I think that there's a fine line, and I get in this argument pretty frequently about pointing out this oppression that's happening, that's very real, you know, from city council related BS, governance over my body at all levels. That's very real, but it is really important, as this person points out, to not stop there and say, you know, wah, the patriarchy, but to actively educate people, particularly educate men, about what that structure looks like. And as Elena pointed out in that article, just make different choices. Just say, hey, that's actually not the society I want to live in. What if our values were about this instead? And what if you were judged as a person instead of as a gender? Wouldn't that be freaking awesome? So, and that is where we come to something that I want to read big chunks of, a great article that I saw after my very unfortunate run-in with a supposedly growing branch of folks known as the men's rights movement, who perceive an oppression on men that they claim is systemic as a backlash from these gains of second wave feminism. They'll point to a handful of issues for evidence of this, but the internet as a whole, I kind of refer to the internet as this entity, but specifically the feminist blogosphere is a great resource for combating these claims. There's been a lot of attention drawn to just the ridiculousness of the claims of men's rights activists in general. And I think this article might have been the best thing that I read along those lines. I got in a lot of arguments about this. I was called a feminazi, all of these stock terms for saying things like, you know, patriarchy is real because sexual violence is more often committed against women. That's something we can just say, you know. For saying things like, I don't want to live in a world where, you know, one third of women are sexually assaulted over their life. Like, that's that's not a radical thing to say. I could say more radical things that would make these people more angry, but I found myself being attacked for very, like, I felt friendly, undeniable claims. And so here is an assessment of maybe some of these men's rights activists and their misunderstandings of things like privilege and power and all that. This is by Lindy West, and I think it was originally published on Jezebel. The headline is, "If I admit that hating men is a thing, will you stop turning it into a self-fulfilling prophecy?" Okay, so maybe you are a man. Maybe you haven't had the easiest ride in life. Maybe you grew up in poverty. You've experienced death, neglect, and despair. You hate your job, your car, your body. Maybe somebody pulverized your heart, or maybe you've never been loved enough to know what a broken heart feels like. Maybe stuff started out unfair and became irreparable, and you never deserved any of this. Maybe everything looks fine on paper, but you're just unhappy and you don't know why. These are human problems, and other human beings feel for you very deeply. It is hard to be a human. I am so sorry. However, though it is a seductive scapegoat, I understand why it attracts you. None of these terrible, painful problems in your life were caused by the specter of misandry. You can rest easy about that, I promise. In fact, the most powerful proponent of misandry in modern internet discourse is you, specifically your dogged insistence that misandry is a genuine, systemic, oppressive force on par with misogyny. That is specious, it hurts women, and it is hurting you. Most feminists don't hate men as a group. We hate the system that disproportionately favors men at the expense of women. But congratulations, we are starting to hate you. You, the person, your obsession with misandry has turned misandry into a self-fulfilling prophecy. I mean, sort of. Hating individuals, men, is not the same as hating all men, but more on that in a minute. Are you happy now? Is this what you wanted? Feminism is, in essence, a social justice movement. It wants to take the side of the alienated and the marginalized, and that includes alienated and marginalized men. Please stop turning us against you. It is nearly impossible to address problems facing women, especially problems in which men are even tangentially culpable, without comment sections devolving into cries of misandry from men and replies of misandry isn't real from women. Feminists are tired of this endless, fruitless game. Hollow conversation built on willful miscommunication, bouncing back and forth, until both sides throw up their hands and bolt. That's exactly what happened to me on Facebook in other news. Maybe you're tired of it too. We seem to be having some very deep misunderstandings on this point, so let's unpack it. I promise not to yell. Part 1. Why feminism has femme in the name, or why can't we all just be humanists? I wish more than anything that I could be a humanist. Oh man, that would be amazing. Because that would mean that we lived in a magical world where all humans were born on equal footing, and maybe I could live in a house shaped like a big mushroom and birds would help me get dressed or something. Humanism is a gorgeous dream and something to strive for. In fact, it's the exact thing that feminism is striving for right now and has been working on for decades. Unfortunately, the reason that femme is part of the word feminism is that the world is not currently an equal, safe, and just place for women, and other groups as well. In its idealized form, intersectional feminism seeks to correct all those imbalances. To remove the gendered implications of the term is to deny that those imbalances exist, and you can't make problems disappear just by changing feminism to humanism and declaring the world healed. That won't work. Part 2. Why claiming that sexism isn't real is a sexist thing to say. We live in a world of measurable, glaring inequalities. Look at politicians, CEOs, film directors, law enforcement officers, comedians, tech professionals, executive chefs, mathematicians, and on and on and on. These fields are dominated by men, and in most cases, white men. To claim there is no systemic inequality keeping women and minorities out of those jobs is to claim that men, people like you, are just naturally better. If there's no social structure favoring men, then it stands to reason that men simply work harder and/or are more skilled in nearly every high-level specialized field. It's fine, although discouraging, if you legitimately believe that, but you need to own up to the fact that it is a self-serving and bigoted point of view. If you do not consider yourself a bigot, then kindly get on board with those of us who are trying to proactively correct inequalities. It is not enough to be neutral and tacitly benefit from inequality while others are left behind through no fault of their own. Anti-sexism, anti-racism, anti-homophobia, anti-transphobia, that's where we're at now. Catch up or own your prejudice. Part 3. Why people being crappy to you is not the same as you being systematically disenfranchised. There might be a lot of women in your life who are mean to you, but that's just women not liking you personally. Women are allowed to not like you personally, just like you are allowed to not like us personally. It's not misandry, it's miskevendry, or you know, whoever you are. It is not built in our culture or codified into law, and you can rest assured that most women you encounter are not harboring secret, latent, gendered prejudices against Kevins that could cost you a job or an apartment or your physical sanctity. That doesn't mean that there aren't isolated incidents wherein mean women hurt men on purpose, but it's not a systemic problem that results in the mass disenfranchisement of men. There are some really crappy things about being a man. You're 100% right about that. You're held up to unreasonable expectations about your body and your career and your ability and desire to conform to traditional modes of masculinity, just like women are with traditional femininity. And that is absolutely oppressive. There are radical feminists and deeply wounded women and women who just don't have the patience for diplomacy anymore who absolutely hate you because of your gender. However, for what it's worth, I do not personally know a single woman like that. That is an unpleasant situation to be in, especially when you also feel like you're being blamed for the seemingly distant problems of people you've never met and towards whom you feel no particular animus. The difference is, though, that the RadFem community on Tumblr does not currently hold the reins of power in every country on Earth. Even in nations with female heads of state, the political and economic power structures are still dominated by men. You do, abstractly. No, you don't have the ability or responsibility to fix those imbalances single-handedly, but refusing to acknowledge that power structure is a slap in the face to people actively disadvantaged by it every day of their lives. You may not benefit from patriarchy in any measurable way. On an individual level, your life actually might be much, much worse than mine. But the fact is that certain disadvantages are absent from your experience and likely invisible to you because of your gender. And there's a long, this article continues, but I'm running out of time. It's a good article, and it talks about this idea that really, she nailed it when she talked about why femme is in the word feminism. You know, until it's an equal playing field from birth, then, you know, you don't get to just call it humanism. So hopefully this was a productive, I was reading a lot of other people's material, but it was pretty cool nonetheless. Talk about the feminism and the patriarchy, something I, like I said, think about all the time because it comes to me every single day. So, yeah, I think women own it and men help us own it in a way, just like any act of solidarity. I think the main thing is to listen to the people who you want to quote unquote help, not come in with your own idea of what's good and impose that on other people. So yeah, as long as we try to do that, I think we'll be all right. And I've got good stuff lined up for the next month. So I hope you keep tuning into the show. There's a lot lined up. I'm not going to list it all because I'm running out of time. So thanks for listening. This has been Praxis. You can get the podcast at kyrs.org/ click on programs, podcasts, Praxis. You can always email me with ideas or suggestions either at facebook.com/praxisradio or at praxis@kyrs.org. Thanks so much for listening. You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM.